Well, hello everyone, and we're glad you're back for another Basic Conversation. And of course, Father Jim Basic is sitting across from me, and we have our great producer and sound engineer, Chris from WGTE. We're always thankful that Chris is here, right?
Oh, he is an expert and helps us a lot.
And he helps a lot of other people in podcasting.
He does great work, for sure.
We're fortunate to have Chris. But Father Basic, today we're talking about Mohandas Gandhi. Can it get any bigger than that?
No, I'm looking forward to it, actually. Here's how I'm thinking about it, that what we would like to try to do is enter into Gandhi's thought world and action world and see how it might enrich our own understanding. In other words, this is one of those exercises of passing over to another viewpoint, a different world, an Eastern world, a Hindu world, and seeing how that might enrich ourselves. After this podcast, we're going to step back into our own world, Western world, United States, and all that that means. And maybe people who listen will move back into their regular life and somewhat enriched.
That sounds like a great goal. Yeah. Where should we start?
That's a good question. I'm thinking that I want to start with his general philosophical, theological outlook. Although we should remember a few things about him. He's an Indian, obviously. His name is Mohandas Gandhi. As time went on, he became popularly known as the Mahatma, which means great-souled one. So he's sort of an unexceptional student in India, and he eventually decided to go to England to study and to become a lawyer, which he did, and that was important in his whole life. He wrote a book called My Experiments with Truth. And that becomes so important in understanding him. So we contrast our normal way of thinking in the Western world of that we're after self-fulfillment. And often we talk about it with Maslow, self-actualization, how we become more of what we want to be. And that drives us. And we live in what we call a success ethic. Culture. We reward people who achieve, make more money, have higher status and more acclaim, who are successful in many ways. We always are dealing with the danger of emphasizing material goods over spiritual ones, of valuing money more than other things. So people will get hung up on the idea, well, I'm driven by my job, my work, and unfortunately my family, where I might find real happiness, is second place. So it might be, it's a characterization, but there's a feeling we have of self-fulfillment, self-actualization. Well, Gandhi came at life in a very different way. So he thought that the problem in life was illusion, which is true in generally in the Eastern world. The Buddhists see the same way. The problem is illusion. We don't see clearly. And that the great task in life is not so much self-fulfillment, but self-realization of coming to know who we truly are. And so Gandhi, he wrote that book, My Experiments with Truth, in which he talks about it. And one of the key things he got out of his Hindu scriptures, he was a religious person and a faith-filled person. And actually, he was influenced by the West. So he was influenced by Western thinkers of various types. Thoreau, for example. Henry David Thoreau and his civil disobedience. He was very influenced by Tolstoy, the Russian author, and so on. And and very much by Jesus, which we'll maybe get to more. So he's after self-realization. And the great quest in life then is to find truth. We could use a lot of that in our culture today, you
for
know.
Sure.
How about more efforts at truth
in
our national dialogue? We're after truth. You know, as Hannah Arendt says, if we don't have an agreement on factual truth, on what actually happened, we can't have a working society. And so Gandhi could be a good corrective of that sort of thing as well. So we're pursuing truth.
And he said truth is God.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You get that. You got the summary statement down.
Truth
cold.
Is God, right?
Truth is God. God is truth. Yeah. So if we were looking at how he sees God, we're after truth, and we have to have self. We got to get over our illusions. And he got that a lot from the Hindu holy books called the Bhagavad Gita. It's often called the Gita, primary holy book for Hindus. And in there, there's this fellow Arjuna, a princely person, is faced with a dilemma. That is, he's going to have to fight another group, but they're his kinfolks. So now what's he going to do? You know, he doesn't want to kill his own relatives. And fortunately, the avatar Krishna comes down and presents himself as the avatar in Arjuna's chariot. And this avatar tells him fundamentally, no, you have to fight, but you should fight while renouncing the fruits of action. And what that meant is you have to fight without worrying so much about the results. Mm. Put your work into effort, doing it right. So Gandhi once said that teaching in the Bhagavad Gita is the matchless remedy for the human condition. Matchless remedy. Renounce the fruits of action. Mm. And now, so that to us would sound sort of passive, I suppose, and without much, doesn't sound active enough. He had what he called a Satyagraha campaign. He called, that's in his language, we translated into this truth force. Satyagraha, truth force. That's what we're going to use to make the world better. Hmm. So Gandhi, all the way along the line, was dedicated to public service. How's he going to make the world a better place and so on? You know, I remember trying that in my golf game in putting. Renounce the fruits of action. Don't worry so much if it's going in or not, but try to stroke it properly.
Don't worry about the outcome.
Yeah, it didn't work. Thus, this Eastern thought of Gandhi in terms of applied to my golf game did not work at all. So, however, there's something to be said for it in life, that is to put in effort. Effort becomes more important than success. That's what Gandhi would be telling us. Effort is more important than success. Now, we use that in the sporting world, don't we? You lost a game, but I'm proud of you because you put forth your best effort, right?
Yeah.
Don't we do that in the world of sports?
I think another term that's related to that I've seen in your writings is desireless action. Which is similar.
That's a way of trying to say it in our language, desireless action.
And it also helps us not get too high when things are great or too low when things are bad.
Yeah.
It's a dispassionate look in some ways.
Yeah. Oh, good. You picked that up. I love that. Yeah.
Hard to do.
Very hard for us in the Western world. Yes. That's what's interesting about passing over to somebody like Gandhi. It's so different. And it forces us maybe to rethink a little bit. and back the other. I did. How about, you know, sometimes we're trying to straighten out a situation and say, I did my best. Didn't work. You know, I tried to help this person, and I tried to listen and give good advice and so on, but he's still an alcoholic and still can't control his drinking. So I, in terms of ministry as a priest, that was often important to say, you know, I did my best, and I put it in God's hands. I don't control the result. You know, it's sort of letting go. Part of what Gandhi talked about was put in terms of finding our true self. That's familiar to some people in the Western world through Thomas Merton. Merton picked up on that. The goal in life is to get past our false self, the self that we might have portrayed to the public or impress our friends or to make it in the business world. But Merton kept on about what we got to find is our true self. Put aside all of the efforts to impress and just be in touch with who we are. And Merton had that same idea. You find your true self, you find God. So there's a good link up with our world, I think. A lot of people know Merton's thought in the Western world. So Gandhi wants us to find our true self and renounce the fruits of action to get there.
Let me throw something at you as far as the service aspect, because you just brought that up. But back in his growing up days, there's this thing with he and his father
where he was... that story, you want me to repeat that story?
Yeah, that's really...
Yeah, it brings up a whole other aspect. So he was very dedicated to his father, and his father was ill, and he attended to his father. That's for a lot of people today, attending to their elderly is so much time-consuming or demanding with longer lives and so on. So he was very attentive to his father, but he was like a nursing kind of person for his father. And then when his father died, he wasn't with him. He was with his wife, Kasturbai. That was an arranged marriage when they were both about 13 years old. That was a big part of his life. But he was obviously, he said it, in the grip of lust with his wife. I think we'd like to say, well, he was having his normal relationship with his wife when his father died, but it put him into a guilt feeling. There's Eric Erickson has written books about Gandhi from an American psychological angle, and he thinks that's a major event in Gandhi's life, and that it put him in a mind, I have to serve the public, I have to serve my country. I have to take care of my father, who I wasn't there at the crucial moment. There was a lot of guilt feelings about that. I mean, you know, from our modern Christian way, we would say, well, I mean, he was there when it counted. You know, he was there all those months taking care of his father, not to be there. I deal with people a lot of times like that, who were not there at the precise moment of death. And one of the things I like to say is, well, you were there all those years. You know, you were there when he was hurting and needed you and so on. And at the point of death, let's put him in God's. This is the widow who's grieving that she wasn't there when her husband died. And so you were there all the time for him when it was important. But that... Erickson thinks that drove Gandhi for public service, the fatherland, in a sense, he was going to take care of and try to bring greater justice and so into all of that. Go back to Kasturbai, his wife. We would not put Gandhi forward as a model husband who entered into a partnership with his wife. She bore him a number of children and so on. And at one point, without dialogue, he announced that he was going to live a celibate life. In our modern Western world, that doesn't ring too well, does it? I mean, of the way husband and wife should interact. But it was a patriarchal society, and he did that. You know, and that, which brings up that larger point of renunciation, which was so important to him. Renounce the fruits of action. He wanted to discipline himself. He did hard things. He ate very frugally. Without getting past that point, he often fasted, fasted for a cause. When he went to, in his life, you know, after he was a lawyer, he got his law degree in England, went back to India, tried to practice law, and was not successful at all. And he got a offer of a job in South Africa. And he went to South Africa, and there, Indians, who were called coolies, were treated like the blacks were treated in that apartheid South Africa. Terrible. And he had a lot of encounters with discrimination. There was one night he was boarding a train, and he was sitting in the regular compartment, and he was told he had to go sit where the coolies sit, where all the Indians sit, and he refused to do it, and the constable threw him off the train, and he spent the night in a railway station, cold place, and alone with his thoughts and so on, and feeling really upset about how he was treated and so on, and decided at that point that instead of feeling sorry for himself, that he would try to do what he could to improve the life of Indians in South Africa, which he was used his lawyerly skills and other things to, and he did make some progress in on how Indians were treated in South Africa.
So that train incident was a catalyst to merge service with social justice.
Brings it together, yeah. At least that's how Erickson sees it and other Westerners see it. But that renunciation, renouncing food, renouncing sex, renouncing success, was all part of strengthening himself for the struggle for freedom, which eventually brings him back to India, where he is now faced with colonialism. So Britain controlled India, and now his problem is, how does he free his country from British rule? And so he was convinced that a Satyagraha campaign, a truth force campaign, would help him to do that. But I don't want to forget about, he had a great love of Jesus. He saw Jesus, as he calls him, once, the Prince of Satyagraha. In other words, he loved the Sermon on the Mount. He loved the idea Jesus said, put away the sword. He saw Jesus as a great teacher, and whom he admired very much. He was very much in tune with Tolstoy, and who again emphasized, out of the Russian tradition, Jesus as the renouncer of violence. Yeah. So yeah, I want to get that Jesus thing in there. That's a link up for us, and why he sees part of his dialogue with Christianity was that way. He thought the teaching of Jesus was great, but the practice of his followers was not all that great, because often his followers were involved in discrimination and so on, and forgot the message of nonviolence. So he begins to work. Now his life task becomes, how do you free India from from the British rule. He wanted to make it so the British would see, leave voluntarily, didn't want to fight them or anything. They would see that it was in their own best interest to let India to be free. So
he did a lot of talking initially, but then when the words and the didn't work, he then went about the nonviolent.
Yes, used nonviolent approaches. Yeah, one of the things that he did was to try to get the Indian people to be more self-sufficient. So that's the story of the spinning wheel. Mm. The spinning wheel was the idea that the Indian people, instead of buying British goods, would make their own goods. Through the spinning wheel, they create thread and cloth and make their own clothes. And so the spinning wheel became the great symbol of taking hold of one's own life, and a way of resisting the British rule. The other thing was what we called the Great Salt March. The Indians suffered greatly. The British had control over the salt market. It was an economic thing, and the Indians had to pay a tax, and that's how British took advantage of the Indians. And it also contributed to the poverty of Indian people. So it was actually against the law to have salt. Hmm. And so he was a pioneer of marches. He had a lot of different ways of trying to get his point across, you know. Work stoppages, for example. So I think it was in 24 days he walked 240-some miles to the sea. Long salt march. And this is one of those symbolic actions. And so when he gets to the sea, he reaches down and picks up a bit of the salt, possesses himself. And he began to encourage all Indian people to do that. And so that again became a nonviolent way of trying to show that people to be self-sufficient. I think that's an important part of this, take hold of their own lives. I think we picked that up in our Western world in terms of those of us who are privileged, how do we help those who are less fortunate in our own country? And I think we've come to see it's not by telling them what to do, you know, it's not by taking over their lives. It's by empowering others so that other people, the dispossessed, the marginalized, can take hold of their own lives and shape it. So, you know, for the minority groups, those of us who are privileged can't tell them what to do. We would like to be there to assist them in whatever way.
Where did the fasting come in as a strategy?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Fasting was big for Gandhi. He fasted regularly himself. And he inaugurated what he called fasts unto death. That's where he would say, until this is solved, I'm not going to eat. He once went 21 days without eating. I think he used that 16 different times in his life. He undertook a fast unto death, and it made the news and so on. One of the things he was so concerned about through the whole independence movement was that Hindus and Muslims would get along. He had to try to find out how the two different groups. Within Hinduism, there were the classes. There were the untouchables. And he established a community, an ashram, as he called it, a place where people could live together, and untouchables were part of the group. So that word was said, they were shunned, they were the outcasts, they were really the marginalized people. And so he brought them into his own, I think one of his plays was called Tolstoy Farm. And he had these untouchables living there. So again, it's acting out the idea that they are God's creatures as well, and we have to respect them and so on. So, fasting unto death, and the world would follow it. I mean, it would be in the papers of how often he would, you know, I believe he went 21 days on without.
So he had the moral stature that the world watched.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a moral man. In other words, that was the thing about him. He was convinced of these things, and I mean, violence, most of all, I wanted to renounce violence. Right. And one time, one of his movements became violent, and there were number of his own people who got killed. He called it a Himalayan mistake, a Himalayan mistake that he allowed that violence. And his reaction was, we're going to fast. We all have to fast to sort of make up for. So I think a lot of it was to find interior strength to remain faithful to truth by renouncing all these things. Renunciation became a big avoiding violence. And of course, we've picked up on all of that, right? I mean, in the Western world. So where are we at here, Brad?
One of the phrases that you've used before in your writing is that he was a servant of mankind.
Yeah.
Pretty global title.
Yes.
There.
He became an international figure. He rose, he was a Hindu thoroughly through and through. Loved the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. But he was open to a larger world. As I said, he learned from Thoreau and Tolstoy and others. And he became a universal figure, which much to his credit. And that's one reason I think we could still learn from him today. But we have to go back to when independence came, and the British did exactly what he hoped they would do, voluntarily withdraw. And I always like to think that his nonviolent ways worked. I mean, that's one of the great things about it. I mean, in the Western world, you're not going to get any place that way. You got to push yourself. We need more arms, more armament. That's how we're going to be safe in our world, you know. And he showed that it actually worked. But when it came in the national celebration of independence, he refused to participate. Refused to participate in because he hadn't brought together the Muslims and the Hindus. And we ended up with two states, right? India and Pakistan. Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan. And people moved to live in the geography where they were appreciated and so on. So he saw that as a very disappointing thing.
And obviously a tragic irony is that he was assassinated, a violent means, right?
Yeah, by a Hindu nationalist. Yeah. Came up to him, and he was always open. I mean, he wasn't guarded or anything, and shot him 3 times in the chest, yeah. So then he became a martyr to the cause, which probably increased his stature in the international community. He's now a martyr to the cause.
Yeah. How about if we finish, Father Basic, with what you said at the beginning? What are the main takeaways of Gandhi's life and efforts?
For us, yeah.
For us.
I wish we could do that efficiently. What would we take away? I mean, I think that the idea of self-realization is a legitimate Christian understanding. It's part of our Western world out of Greek, know thyself. as Socrates and Plato, know thyself, understand. I think we're a lot of us who like Thomas Merton are already into it. So he reinforced the idea, yeah, let's find our true self. And that does require discipline, to not get carried away with accolades that come our way, for example, to try to remain humble in the midst of that, to always realize we have more to learn. So by passing over to Gandhi, what would we do? We would try to be aware of illusions in our lives. You know, where don't I understand myself? It could be that some people I deal with, they don't understand their virtues. You know, they don't really appreciate what the goodness they've done. And part of helping them spiritually is to say, well, you've forgotten this. You know, you made a good marriage for 20 years. Oh, that was a great accomplishment. Sometimes that's what's needed. Sometimes the other way, pride. You didn't really do that all by yourself, you know. You are a successful businessman, but you wouldn't have got there without your husband who helped you do it. Or you wouldn't have got there without your mother giving you a good example. You're now a major figure in the economic world, but people got you there. So maybe that would be another good takeaway. Just to pass over to somebody who's very different somehow enriches us. We'll come back to our ordinary life, living in the United States, a competitive dog-eat-dog culture and so on, tough business world and so on, but maybe we come back a little more enlightened.
Well, this has been a great conversation, and thank you, Father Basic, for highlighting the substance and great virtue of Gandhi.